Greetings, everyone. Can you hear me? Okay, excellent. So we're in our third series of ways to pray in the Old Testament and today. And on behalf of Nassau Church Adult Education Committee, I just want to say it's so great to see all of you. And we're so excited about this series, especially today when we have the very Reverend Dr. Kathy Sachenfeld. She's retired from the Princeton Seminary Old Testament faculty in 2013. Her special interests are the Pentateuch and stories of women throughout the Old Testament. An ordained PCUSA clergywoman, she has participated in the life of Nassau Church since 1970 and has served the denomination at Presbytery, national, and international levels. She currently serves on Nassau's Adult Education Committee, thank you for that, and on the Nassau Witherspoon Street Partnership Team. Please give a warm welcome to Reverend Dr. Kathy Sachenfeld.
Thank you all for being here. I told Marshall that if he carried on like that, he had to laugh, and you were supposed to laugh too. You've known me as Kathy for a very long time, so don't get too excited about it. I'd like to, let me just say at the outset, back on that table, I brought, I don't know how many, 8 or 9, 10 books of prayers that I find helpful in my life. And you're invited to go back and look at them at the end during the coffee hour. And there's a sheet that has the detailed bibliography of each of them in case anybody wanted to try to find them. Some of them at best would be unused books because they're very old, but you could look. Also, I do need to leave pretty quickly. I can speak to you briefly afterward if you want. But Len is going to pick up the books at the end of the coffee hour and put them in the office for me, so you'll have plenty of time to look even if I'm gone. We're talking about intercessory prayer, but I'd like us to begin with a prayer from Ted Loader's Guerrillas of Grace, which some of you may be familiar with. I see a couple of heads nodding. And it's not quite an intercessory prayer, but it's implicitly there. And the heading he gave for it is, "Sometimes it just seems to be too much." So let's pray together. Sometimes, Lord, it just seems to be too much. Too much violence, too much fear, too much of demands and problems, too much of broken dreams and broken lives, too much of war and slums and dying, too much of greed and squishy fatness and the sounds of people devouring each other and the earth, too much of stale routines and quarrels, unpaid bills and dead ends, too much of words lobbed in to explode and leaving shredded hearts and lacerated souls, too much of turned away backs and yellow silence, red rage, and the bitter taste of ashes in my mouth. Sometimes the very air seems scorched by threats and rejection and decay until there is nothing but to inhale pain and exhale confusion. Too much of darkness, Lord. Too much of cruelty and selfishness and indifference. Too much, Lord, too much, too bloody, bruising, brainwashing, much. Or is it too little? Too little of compassion, too little of courage, of daring, of persistence, of sacrifice. Too little of music and laughter and celebration. O God, make of me some nourishment for these starved times, some food for my brothers and sisters who are hungry for gladness and hope, that being bread for them, I may also be fed and be full. Amen. I'm going to give this to Marshall so he can put it on the And you can start passing out the handouts at the same time. I think there are probably enough, but if not, obviously you can share. Going to be talking our way through through some of these, and I got to find my own copy would be a good idea here. You'll see when you get these that what I've it isn't quite as sharp as I would have liked because I had to scan them on my home toy scanner. But what I wanted to do was label it by sections. And so you'll see that on page one it says context, and then as it goes on, there are sections that are numbered 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on through 8, and then the final blessing at the very end. And I thought that doing it that way would help us to follow along, and then you can we'll have some discussion of the different sections as we go along. We were encouraged to say a little bit as speakers about our personal history in prayer life, if we were willing to do that, and so I'll just tell you a few things that may have some relevance to what we're talking about. Kindergarten, bow your heads and fold your hands. And in school and in church and in school, because of the time that it was, there was lots of memorization of Psalms and New Testament verses. In grade 6, it was a critical moment for me. In Sunday school, we sat in a circle, and each child was expected to say some sort of one or two sentences of prayer to conclude the Sunday school class. And I guess that's where we began to learn to pray out loud without being too anxious about it, just whatever came into your head. But it was during the Korean War, and every single child, including me, said, "And dear Lord, please bring back our boys safe from Korea if it be thy will." That was the standard phrase. And I remember thinking as a 10-year-old in that group, what a crock. I mean, the "if it be thy will" was like, okay, so whatever happens, it was God's will. God can do whatever God wants. I mean, you know, we're not really, this. How could this, you know, be a serious prayer? But anyway, you can see it was an intercessory prayer, and already my little childhood mind is saying, well, you know, how is that going to work? Well, I may be at a stage now where I'm thinking to myself, is it actually that God is waving some kind of a wand and this one dies and this one doesn't? That is not where I could be anymore, but that was where the whole question about intercessory prayer that we'll have to struggle with a bit this morning came into my life. But thinking about communal contexts have always been important for me. So participating in what we call public worship or church services, small groups. For decades, I was in the Friday morning Bible study, which included prayer that went on here through Nassau. I'm in a meditation group. I have participated for now 4 years or so online in Episcopal morning prayer, which means a lot to me. I also find for myself that reading prayers by other people is very helpful to me. So that's why you've got all those books back there. And I am going to find a cough drop because this is a standard problem with my voice. I always tell my students at the beginning of the semester, don't worry if I have a coughing fit, just wait. And I do have water, thanks. Thank you. Thanks to Marshall. So let me talk a little bit about the context of this chapter, which I doubt that any of you have read, even in advance. Even the assigned part was 30 verses, which is longer than any of the other ones we're dealing with in this series. The setting of this whole chapter, where I've labeled it context, is in the temple. It's the dedication of the first temple in Jerusalem, which Solomon organized to get built. And in the first part, it describes how they brought the Ark of the Covenant. They mentioned the tent, but the Ark of the Covenant particularly is brought to this new sanctuary, and the priests carry it in and put it with its long poles underneath the cherubim, which are in the back darkest part of the sanctuary. And the wings of the cherubim, which are like two, they're not wings, fins, but they're animals with big wide wings that go from one side of the building to the other, and this is put underneath them. And as background, the image is, in general, of the deity, God, the Lord, is enthroned invisibly, sitting on top of these wings of the cherubim, and the ark, which is the box that the Ten Commandments are in, that Moses organized and put in there after he received the stone tablets, that's sort of the footstool for the invisible God who is enthroned on these cherubim. So that's the visual picture that we've got. And the thing that's interesting about this introduction is that it brings together the tradition of the covenant that was made in the time of Moses with the whole people, which is generally thought of as a covenant where God says, if you will be faithful, you will be my people. But what happens if you're not so faithful? And then there's a covenant that God makes with King David and says, okay, I promise that there will always be a descendant of your line, King David. Solomon is his son, of course, on the throne. But hidden in the covenant in the time of Moses, there's a little forgiveness clause that shows up every once in a while. And in the covenant made with David, there's a little, but maybe if the king is bad, or maybe if the people aren't following rightly, might be the king's fault or whatever, things might not go so well. And there might not be a king anymore. So even though you've got these two emphases, they kind of come together. And without going through all of the material that we have here in the introduction, those two themes are brought together here. And Solomon gives this long thing to the people where he's remembering that the whole story of Nathan and David and how David wanted to build this temple, but God said, no, you're not going to do it. Your son is going to do it. And so now I'm his son, and I've done it, and see, you've fulfilled this promise that you made to David, and I'm on the throne, and I've built this. The Lord, at the very end of verse 20, has upheld the promise he made, for I have risen in the place of my father. I sit on the throne, and I have built the house for the name of the Lord, and have provided a place for the ark. So that connects the Moses tradition to this tradition here. And it's really a place where all of that is pulled together. So then we get Solomon beginning his prayer, and he relates the temple as the place that he has built for the Lord to sit in, invisibly enthroned, to the problem that God is so great that who could keep God inside a box or inside a temple or inside a building? And he remembers all those promises, and then he says in the key verse 27, if you can see the numbers there, but will God indeed dwell on the earth? Even heaven and the highest heaven cannot contain you, much less this house that I have built. And so that opens up the theme that we'll see as we go through the rest, that God is to hear the prayer in heaven that will be made at any time and should respond to that. And so that brings us to the intercessory prayers. And I should just say, points 2 through 8 on here are the various prayers on forgiveness and rescuing from trouble. This prayer, I mean, Solomon is saying, if this happens, then so-and-so forgive. When this happens, whatever it is, forgive. It's all anticipatory. Now, nobody had a tape recording in the time of King Solomon. We don't know if Solomon actually said all these things or if someone has placed these in the mouth of Solomon much later. But as we see, as we look at the things that he prays about, we know from the rest of the history of the books of 1st and 2nd Kings that they do all happen. And these issues that Solomon raises in this anticipatory way in this great prayer are things that will be taking place as it goes on. And I think number 8 on the handout, we'll get to that a little later, don't panic. But I think it clearly must represent a time in the exile, 400 years or something after the time of Solomon. So it's possible that part of this was there and things were, you know, redacted and added over the centuries as people were copying. And, you know, in those days there wasn't any idea that you couldn't change a text once it was written down. You could, you know, fix it up to fit the occasion was considered just fine and appropriate and a good thing to do. So, okay, what I'd like us to do is, if you were willing, please be willing, divide into small groups of 4 or 5 at the most. And I'm going to assign, after you've circled into a group, sections 2, 3, 4, and 5 to different groups. And if there are more than 4 groups, then there'll be two groups on the same thing. And your assignment is going to be read it, take a minute to think. Are you comfortable with the content of what's there? What questions do you have about it? Why do you like it? Why do you hate it? Why do you like it? And can you relate it in any way to praying today? And so each group will have a different section of Solomon's intercessory prayer to think about those questions. I'll repeat the questions after you're in the group and you have your numbers. And then we'll hear back what some of the different groups thought about the different prayers that they had. So quickly get into some kind of a group. And I'll see how many groups there are and then come around and give you an assignment. Have you got enough room there? Okay, there you go. Okay. Yeah, the groups don't have to be of some exact size. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, so we got 5 groups. Okay. Okay, well, you take number 2, and let's see. You all take number 5, and you've got 3, and we'll have, let's have 2 number 4s over here, okay? Pardon? Well, 2, 4s. It'll be kind of big, but if that's what you prefer to do, you may do it. Go ahead. Okay, and your assignment again is to read it. Will somebody read it aloud? What do you think about that prayer? Are you comfortable with the prayer or not? Do you like that prayer? Do you hate that prayer? Do you care about that prayer? Would you pray that way? Or can you think of any way to relate it to praying today? Or you just would say, I mean, there are a lot of things in the Old Testament that we don't like. So this is your chance, if you don't like it, to say so. But then also to think hard about, can you do something with it? Can you wrestle with it to find a blessing, as they say? And then somebody who can report briefly from your group so that everybody later on can hear. And you got about, whatever, 8 eight minutes or so to just dig into it just a little bit. You just stretching, or you have a question? Oh, yeah, sure. Okay, so you've read your little couple of verses, and are you comfortable with them? Do you not like it? Do you think it's, you don't like something about that prayer, or you do like something about that prayer? Would you or wouldn't you pray that way today? Is there any way, if you don't like it, that you could connect it up, or if you do like it, that you could connect it up to anything the way you would pray today? About what? All right, so you're number five, right? Okay, so you've got all this list of bad things, and then you've got any individual or any group that pray, then would God forgive? There's every time in all of these, here in your dwelling place, and forgive and act, okay, so that they may fear you. Now, what does act mean? Does it mean get rid of the plague, the blight, the mildew, the locust, and the caterpillar, or the enemy, or whatever happens, that if the people pray, that will go away? Or what does it mean? I mean, it's likely that's implied. So, is that... Okay, there's a drought, what should I do? There's a plague, what should I do? Anyway, that's kind of the question. Okay, does that help?
Literally.
You've got about another minute or so. Be sure you've picked someone who will give us a summary. Okay, can you begin to wrap up, please? Or, as Frieda Gardner used to say, when the person who's speaking now has finished her or his comment, can we gather together again? Oh, I see, they're still debating about the reporter. Okay. All right. Can we come back together again so we can share a little bit of what we've done? You gotta pass that thing around now, yeah? Okay. Thank you all for participating in this. Dave stopped in before. He said, I'm not preaching on the intercessions. I said, well, I'm going to make them work hard. he's got some really good stuff about intercessory prayer, I think, in what the few words he said to me beforehand. Can we hear from group number two? So you've got your text, and you can look and see what they were dealing with there. They've got this one, somebody sins and is given an oath to swear and swears, hear and judge, condemn the guilty, vindicate the righteous. So, who's the reporter? Oh, wait for the mic. I forgot. Hold it close.
Okay, we found this a difficult passage and decided that we really were not in agreement with what it says.
Go ahead.
We were looking at it as if it, the same way as a judge in a court would look at it. You know, that this is deciding, swearing an oath meaning that you swear to tell the truth, et cetera. But then it sort of switches and asks God if, you know, you take over and vindicate the righteous and make the conduct, whatever the person has done, you know, whatever sin has been committed, to bring it back on their own head. And it was mentioned that this seems like the Old Testament idea of vengeance and revenge as opposed to compassion and forgiveness.
Okay, so you have a court case, yeah? And, okay, so let's let the guilty person be punished and the righteous person be recognized. It reminded me of a very long, complicated passage in the Code of Hammurabi, where there's an elaborate case and a person is accused, and then the accuser brings witnesses, and the victim or the person who was accused brings witnesses, and they've got to figure out who was right.
Because, I mean,
it sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it, in the modern court situations.
Yes.
But there they have a system where something happens with the gods and oaths so that it supposedly becomes clear. And if the accuser has made a false accusation, the punishment for that crime is placed upon the accuser. So we might not like quite that approach either, but you're right that it's about difficult cases, and it does sound like there isn't forgiveness for everybody in this one. So reasons not to be comfortable. Okay, we've got lots going on here. Let's move on to group three. I think they were in the middle somewhere.
Okay, two short verses. I would say we were generally comfortable, but there were some problems with this section. The main problem was this idea of reversing the exile and bringing them back to their land. And so there's a fine point here that can be interpreted is, does returning someone to their land mean that they get to be in charge again? That's a fine point we could debate. But in general, the group thought that perhaps we weren't too excited about God giving America back to the Native Americans. And so that was, just a thought. That was part of the discussion. It was noted that in order for God to take action, Solomon lays down some pretty hefty concepts here. Confess God's name, pray and plead, and turn again to you, which is to say that this is not some momentary change of heart, but intended to be a very deep turning of heart,
yeah.
A very deep metanoia.
Okay.
And finally, it was noted the phrase, then here in heaven, which appears in all of these sections.
Yes.
And the notice that Solomon is dedicating the temple, and there's this grandiose concept of the throne of God in the temple, and yet Solomon continues throughout this section to talk about the fact that God can't be contained in the temple, and that God's home is in heaven, and that God, and he asks God to hear in heaven, not here in the temple.
Yeah. And there's some discussion in the historical debates among scholars about whether this was something special for Israel to say, well, you know, it's not just a statue, even the other gods' religions, or did they really also have an idea of a God who was in the heavens? But when you have one God in the heavens, as is, seems to be assumed in this passage, you have a transcendent picture. That issue reminded me of a hymn that was, I think, one of the favorites of Tom Gillespie, who was longtime president at Princeton Seminary. The opening line is, to this temple where we call you, come, O Lord of hosts, today, with your wanton loving kindness, hear your people as they pray, and hereafter with your benediction, spread it upon your people always, or something. I always remember sitting in Miller Chapel and thinking, to this temple where we call you, to this church where, I mean, isn't God always here, or whatever? And then I thought about here at Nassau, one of our sung call to worship Jesus, we are here. So we're not calling, but we're announcing we're here in the presence. So there's something of this thing of God in the heavens, but that there are particular places. And we know how humanly people get attached to sanctuaries. Don't change the carpet. Don't recolor the pews. Don't change the aisles. Even the church library or the women's parlor. You know, so there is something humanly about connecting a physical place of worship and sacredness with the God who is everywhere. Okay, let's hear from group number four. Or we had two groups four, so we'll have two little reports over here.
Well, we said we were, I think, fairly uncomfortable with the idea that disaster is brought by God because of sin, and how that's been used to justify blaming people or nations for terrible things that happen. We also talked about how there is a connection between injustice of humanity stewarding the earth and availability of water and access to water. The other thing that was really interesting is that Larry said he remembered a prayer service in Iowa when there was a drought where they prayed for rain specifically.
Thank you. And let's hear from the other team.
So I was designated as the spokesperson for our group, and we had a similar take on the group sin. Initially, we thought about the ancient times, but we also fast-forwarded to today, and we thought there actually is group sin in terms of climate change with the whole globe. And so we talked a lot about that. And then at the end, Marsha Wood said something really smart, but I can't remember what it was. Marsha. Oh.
Go, Marsha.
I have no idea what it was.
So I think that sums it up.
Okay. Thank you all, and Marsha.
I'll think of it.
So you hear the suggestion that, you know, oh, what sin did those people do, but there might still be a sin. But and yeah, now we're ready for group five. Rush around. Yes, they're way on the other side. I should have organized them to be more contiguous geographically in the room.
Well, thank you very much. So I have been designated by our group. First of all, this is the longest passage, 4 verses we have. And so our group has, the first initial response was, this is showing up one of our friend. This is showing the character of the nation as well, as a people of God. And then when we have reflected upon that, number one, it is a powerful intercessor prayer. And number two, it is from a king who recently, you know, inaugurated as a king, as a father of the nation. So he's interceding on behalf of the whole nation. And as a king, as a part of the DNA of the whole nation, he knows the character of the nation. So that's how he is pleading and interceding. And first of all, especially we're in heaven, in dwelling place. So in my perspective, the temple, the place where he's praying, it was a mini cosmos, the whole temple. That's why when they are using alternative word for God, they are not using direct Adonai or Elohim, they are using heaven. Yeah. So that's kind of alternative name. And number three, the prayer focused mostly on God's character, who God is.
Okay.
And then what is his covenant relationship with his people. So that's why last 2 verses is all focused on God's character, not on people's sins. So that we can read here, the dwelling place, forgive, act, render, verse 39, all those who hear you according to all their way, for you know what is human heart, 40 verse. They may fear you, and then they live in the land that you gave. So this whole prayer, the focus is God's character and his mercy and covenant relationship with his people.
So. Thank you so much. Yes, question?
Well, so in this one, this section, they're not saying that God did this because people sinned, like I said earlier. The famine, plague, blight, mildew, that's not because people sinned against God.
Right. The comment was that this one doesn't begin with, if your people sinned, so that these, and implying that it was some sin of the people that caused it, but just here are these things. And if there's a plea, and this one also, as you pointed out, can be either the individual or the community is making the prayer, but there still seems to be the hear in heaven and forgive as implying that maybe, you know, something should be done, but it isn't made nearly so specific. And the theme that they may live in the land, that keeps coming up. And that comes up even, you know, before the exile. I'd like, just in our remaining few minutes, to make a couple of points about the ones that we didn't discuss. And thank you all for those helpful comments and for your frankness about what you liked and what you really didn't like about these difficult prayers with some of their aspects. Number six is about a foreigner who comes, and you think, oh good, because they will hear of your name, and they will come here in your dwelling place and do everything that the foreigner calls on. So, okay, didn't have to be a genetically born Israelite, but a foreigner could come. But I still get a little uncomfortable because a foreigner has to sign on to Israel's religion in order to be really included. And if we bring that to today in terms of a prayer, for me at least, expecting every immigrant to give up their own faith and culture in order to be included is a difficult thing that obviously is in one way or another very much in the fore with Christian nationalism and everything else that's on the screen today. Number seven is kind of the inverse of one of the other ones, that the people go out to battle, so they're going to go out this time, and if that God should see that they are maintain their cause, that they get to be the winners. Certainly, you know, thinking back to past wars, we pray all the time that our side will win, and that's what this one is about. Yeah. And in the present kinds of conflicts, with each side saying the other one should do this or that, or whose fault it was that everything happened, we feel, whether we like this wording or not, it's a very contemporary issue. And then the long number eight is really expanding on the exile idea that, or bringing people back to the land, and whose land is it that's been mentioned before. But it does assume that they're in enough trouble that they even ask for their captors to have compassion on them. So, you know, in the meantime, until they are brought back to the land, that should happen. So that's just kind of a summary of what's there. And again, you know, at the very end of verse 53, you've separated them from all the peoples of the earth, just as you promised through Moses when you brought the ancestors out of Egypt. So the theme of the era of kingship and the memory of the situation with Moses, and you know, when the people sin in the time of Moses, God says, well, I'm just going to destroy them and start over again. And Moses says, yeah, but you promised. And you promised our ancestors, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Rachel, and Leah. And what are the other nations going to think if something happens to us? You know, remember that you chose us and you did this, and we are assigned to the nations. And so this kind of theme is brought back again in this spot. So, you know, we're left at the end with kind of the question that I started with my childhood question in the sixth grade, and what's implicit in all of these small group topics. Does God intervene directly? How does intercessory prayer work? And probably each one of us would have a little bit different answer. And we pray to God to do something or change something, even if it seems intractable. Even if we don't know, at least I do, I can't say what other people in the room are doing. But it reminded me of two things that I'll say as we're concluding, and I'm looking at the clock. In the book of Ruth, where I've spent a lot of time, there are a lot of people, characters, who pray for God to bless one of the other characters in the story. But in each case, the way the story is laid out, the answer to that blessing, the happening of something beneficial happening to that person, is enacted by the person who made the prayer. So there was an obituary for Rabbi Eric Wisnia in the Town Topics about a month ago, and the parishioners of his temple said that they remembered his favorite saying, and that kind of struck me with regard to intercessory prayer. Prayers don't change things. Prayers change people, and people change things. And the Jewish tradition that draws upon is the Jewish saying, God has no hands but ours. For me personally, that's helpful. Now, when I try to think, what can I do about the situation in the Middle East, I have to bring it down to something very tiny. What Jew or Muslim do I know that I can speak with, but doesn't mean I'm not going to pray for all of those people. So I leave you with that, and I invite you to continue to reflect on it and to hear what Dave has got going, which is a very different take on the passage. And I'm sure very graceful and rewarding. Thank you so much. Appreciate your time and your participation. Yeah, oh, well, I thought we had to quit, but well, I carefully fixed it so there could... No, we have time. But they, since they haven't come out, yes, we can have a couple of questions if anybody has.
But first, I want to give the microphone over to Marcia. Do you remember now?
35 and 36. I think what we were saying was that we were comparing... Marshall said he'd been at Yosemite during a drought. And then they had huge snowfall, and now it's just fine. And I was saying there are natural occurrences like that. I mean, good weather will always follow bad. And bad weather will always follow good, regardless of whether anybody's praying about it or not. So it must have been very rewarding to pray for rain, and then the rain came, and feel as if you did have a God that would control things like that. But I feel differently about climate change and where we are now. I think there's a lot of despair about, all right, so rain follows drought, but what follows climate change? I mean, we don't have those things, but I think you actually answered my concern in your last two comments.
Oh, okay, that's helpful. And I could imagine that in the era of the Dust Bowl, there were people who gave up their faith in God because no matter how much they prayed for rain, nothing happened. And that's the other piece of the challenge. Thanks, Marcia. Yes.
Thank you very much, first of all, this exercise. And today, as you know, it's International Day of Persecuted Church and the prayer for them.
Yes.
And bringing it that, and especially on number six, when you were saying likewise, when a foreigner. And would you think that when Solomon has lots of foreigner wives, you know, lots of relationships, and that's ended up his life in a different way as compared he started? So any comment on that, first of all, his personal life, how it started as a God-fearing king and ended up as a God-forbidden and forgetting a place. And on Solomon's, because I wish someone pray for Solomon also as an intercessor.
Yeah, thank you. It seems that the story does indicate, as you said, that all these foreign wives seem to lead Solomon astray from God, and trouble happens, and the kingdom is divided after Solomon, and that's considered very bad. And all of this text is the rest of Kings is all written from the point of view of the people in Jerusalem. The descendants on Solomon's side, the Davidic side. And so all the people who left in the aftermath of all of that, which was probably very political, are all considered apostate and bad and should come back to Jerusalem. But the other piece that worries me about Solomon and how we remain faithful is that in the Old Testament, it tends always to be the women who lead the men astray. And so I think there's a caution, if we don't think about it, that it could be the other way, or that he was just ready to go anyway, and this encouraged. Now, why Solomon had 900 wives and concubines to begin with is another question. That's only one time every 3 or 4 years per wife or whatever, if you want to put it crassly. And marriages, of course, even as they still are in many parts of the world today, were made for political or tribal reasons. But I don't think he needed 900. It's part of showing his glory. The text is quite ambivalent. In fact, people try to divide it up. Here's a text that shows how great Solomon is. Next one shows how terrible he was. He did this big thing, and he had all these stables and horses. Oh, but look, back here it says, stables and horses are very bad. You should not have them. That looks like you're depending on Egypt. Bad thing to do. So all the time we have that. But thanks, that's a really important thing. Yes?
Last question.
Since you brought up the numbers, I skipped ahead to the last page.
Yes.
Verse 63, Solomon sacrificed 22,000 oxen and 120,000 sheep. That's quite a sacrifice. What are we to make of that?
Yeah, I have the impression, and probably Jim Vanderkam would know, that in the late period, and the, you know, the Greeks and the Romans also sacrificed large numbers of animals on special occasions, but probably not that many thousand. But I think it's part of the exaggeration to talk about the glory and the excitement of this whole thing, that they weren't too worried about literal numbers at that point, I'm sorry to say. I mean, I hope they didn't really do that, let me put it that way. And they also, just when they're bringing, before that part, when they're bringing the ark up to put it in the temple, they're sacrificing all kinds of animals. So it happens twice in this chapter.
Now possible that what we call thousand, they didn't call thousand?
Well, that's kind of, you know.
I was reading a book about mathematical history, and it is true that they would say a thousand, and they could actually mean ten. It was a glorification of a number. So it probably wasn't 120,000 sheep, but this is show, as she said, is glory.
So
yeah.
Oh,
well, you know, in all the ancient Near Eastern traditions, the people before the time of the flood lived thousands of years, some of them much longer than what we even have of the characters in the Bible. But yeah, whether it's, I guess the point is it's more an exaggeration. It might be a proportional one, but it's not like that this word means some smaller number. Yeah.
Thank you, Dr. Sackenfeld. We have to get
going. I'll stay a few minutes.
But next week, I want to thank you all for this great discussion and for your participation in it and for being here today. And next week, we'll continue our Ways to Praise series. Hannah's Prayer Praises God, as discussed and led by her faith testimony and her take on this scripture, Francis Catrician. We hope you'll join us. Thank you.
Thank you all. Oh, thank you. And thanks, Len, for her.
You're still wired. We'll kick you off. You have to switch that up.
Yeah. Oops. Okay.